Welcome to the sixth lecture in the fall program of the Vancouver Institute. I'm very pleased to introduce to you Judge Les Bewley, who graduated in law from the University of British Columbia in 1949. He practiced law for some years and then became assistant city prosecutor and subsequently a magistrate. And he is currently senior trial judge of the County of Vancouver. He's had, I think, a wide-ranging association with this university, varying from being editor of the UBC to being a member of the Board of Governors. He has also been active in journalism, and he will address you this evening on the subject of parole, public safety, and the administration of justice. Judge Bewley.
Dr. Weber, ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to be here, if for no other reason than I don't usually get invited to such high-class places as this. I've spent about the last quarter of a century down on Main and Cordova streets, and practically all my friends and associates are thieves, winos, drunks, and bums. And in the course of it, I think I've probably picked up a lot of social diseases of one kind or another. And usually when I get invited to a respectable place like this, they ask me to go through a sheep dip process before they let me in. But you've been kind, and I missed the sheep dip tonight. So I'll try to be as respectable as I can, considering my origins and background. Just so that we understand each other, it might be fair to tell you that while by statute my office is that of a provincial court judge, what I really am basically is a retreaded old police court magistrate. And I say old because magistrates in Vancouver have tended to disappear rather quickly. I found to my horror the other day that I have outlasted Oscar Orr by 2 years and the late, very great Gordon Scott by four. And I guess I've got the record now. And so it looks to me as if you've caught me just in time before I go to the place where my experience best fits me for. That is, as Beelzebub's right-hand man. The late and great Henry L. Mencken, the sage of Baltimore, I think best describe what a police magistrate is. He said that a police magistrate is a dispirited and debauched individual who has spent too many years listening to lying witnesses and nefarious lawyers. Well, the Law Society and the Civil Liberties Union, and for all I know, the Human Rights Commission, may get wind of this, so I had best put in a disclaimer right away and say that those are not necessarily my views, they're that rascal Mencken's views, about lawyers, that is. But I still feel dispirited and debauched. You may know that provincial court judges in Canada hear and finally dispose of about 95% of all criminal trials in Canada and 100% of the quasi-criminal trials. And I have been on my feet or my behind for the last 22 years, day in and day out, down on Main Street, except for the 22 days annual vacation where the gracious government gives me. There are no long summer vacations in this business and no sabbaticals. And that might be, I suppose, why we don't have long lineups of law professors waiting to become members of this bench. But those 22 years have taught me a few things. Chief among them is the firm belief that paleontologist Dr. Louis Leakey, in his assertion that men and women have been stalking around planet Earth for at least 20 million years, as opposed to the generally accepted 6 million years, is the correct version. There is just no way at all, as I see it, that Homo sapiens could possibly have devised, polished, and refined his present degree of rascality in a mere 6 million years. It must have been at least 20 million, and my own guess is probably 40. Nobody, for example, could possibly come up with the idea of a national parole board unless he had very long training and a special set of genes especially designed to create disaster. Just so there is no misunderstanding either, let me say at once that I'm not here as a spokesman for the judiciary or to express their views or the views of any of them. Some judges disagree with my views, and sometimes very bluntly, I can tell you. The majority of them believe, quite correctly, that judges should not go about making public speeches. You see, under our Constitution, there are three arms of government: Parliament, the executive, or government of the day, and the judiciary. Each has separate and autonomous powers. Each must take great care that it does not intrude upon the functions of the other. Can you hear me all right up the back there? Nods of assent. Right. I would properly resent any cabinet minister or parliamentarian trying to influence or impede or to criticize judicial decisions, and I would expect them properly to resent my engagement in or criticism of the political or administrative process. But what if there should be a pattern of encroachment by one side upon the other? If the executive should encroach on the rights of Parliament, cannot parliamentarians be honestly heard to complain? And if, as I believe, Parliament and the executive, through the Parole Act and the Prisons and Reformatories Act, have honestly, but unwittingly, performed what I can only describe as the most massive intrusion into the judicial function, ought not any judge be heard to complain? These complaints, if valid, ought to be made. The freedom of citizens in a democratic society depends on the checks and balances between the arms of government. And the question is, who makes them? No one would be happier than I if judges had no occasion to or need to. And it is, therefore, out of the very deepest respect for the constitutional division of powers in this country, and for the reason for that division, that I address you tonight. How, for example, do the Parole Board and the Prisons and Reformatories Act intrude on the judicial function? It might be useful to start by reading to you the warrant of committal signed by every sentencing judge in a criminal case. It reads, "To the peace officers in the city of Vancouver, and to the keeper of the BC Penitentiary, you are hereby commanded in Her Majesty's name to take the accused and convey him safely to the BC Penitentiary, and there deliver him to the keeper thereof, together with the following precept. You, the said keeper, are hereby commanded to receive the accused into custody in the said penitentiary and imprison him there for the term of X years." The warrant, you will notice, reads "there." It does not read "or release him from that custody on parole or temporary absence as you or others may decide. It says there, in custody. Now, please do not misunderstand me. Parliamentarians, as the elected representatives of the people, have rightly the power to pass those acts which can set aside or nullify portions of judicial orders. The question is not whether they could, but rather whether they should. The question is evocative of the plea or the problem put by Isabella to all-powerful Angelo in Shakespeare's Measure for Measure. I thought I'd better throw in the fact that Shakespeare's the author, in case you get him confused with Murray Goldman or something. Shakespeare's Measure for Measure. When she's pleading for her brother's life to Angelo, she cried to Angelo and said, "How wondrous to have a giant strength, how tyrannous to use it like a giant." That question might be addressed to Parliament, which has the power to pass acts to hang you all tomorrow without a trial, if it wishes. The law is that when a court, after conviction, has to pass sentence, the court must consider three factors. First, the protection of society. Second, the deterrence of the offender or others who may be disposed to commit his same offense. And third, the rehabilitation of the offender, and they are to be weighed in that descending order. It is, of course, not in every case that the decision must be to confine the offender for a period of time to protect the public from his further depredations and assaults. But where that decision has been made, and especially where that decision has been confirmed by courts of appeal, and you can be assured that that decision is never made lightly or even happily, then that order ought not lightly to be set aside by agents of the executive. Indeed, it can be argued it ought not to be set aside at all, except perhaps by a rare act of executive clemency, wherein the whole cabinet is involved, with political accountability involved, in order to prevent a clear miscarriage of justice not preventable within the courts themselves. But to apply parole, holus bolus, and temporary absence on a widespread scale is to leave the suggestion that the courts do not know what they are doing, that miscarriage of justice is endemic in their proceedings, and that their deliberations and their orders are perhaps not to be taken too seriously by either those who have committed the offense or those contemplating the commission of them. In a homely way, it is rather like one parent having the unhappy task of disciplining a child and then having the other parent tell the child in the presence of all the other children, "Oh well, you know your mother. Just promise me you'll behave in future and you can have your slingshot back." Except that what is involved here generally is much more serious than childish misdemeanors. The function of the trial judge and the courts generally is perhaps best understood by the reminder that there exists a very ancient contract between the citizen and the state, whereby the citizen disarms himself by putting down the club which before he carried daily on his shoulder, on the condition that the tribe or the state would assume as its very first duty to protect him and his family and his property from those who would break the laws or taboos of the tribe. That ancient contract is best described by author Stephen Becker, who once wrote, "The covenant by which man creates a community is an agreement to forego the perilous gratification of an animal existence for the more permanent advantages of human fellowship." And the law is a detailed statement of that covenant. In a state of nature, man is ruled by a lonely violence, not merely characteristic, but essential to his survival. Not merely an attribute, but a right. But because survival is the ultimate value of the lonely beast, the right to survive implies the right to steal, to rape, and to kill. But in accepting the company of his fellows, man yields a measure of that violence in the name of a general tranquility, and society assures him that he has not disarmed himself. Not his survival, once important to him alone, has become the prime care of us all. That is the covenant. And it was born with the most primitive social unit of earliest men. In time, that unit acquired complexity, and so did the covenant, and so did the law. But at the heart of all three, however deeply buried, lies one value: survival. The courts are the principal instrument by which the state observes that contract. You are not merely demeaning the authority of the courts. You are not merely introducing a Gresham's law of coinage to their currency. Heaven knows that is bad enough. You are opening up a Pandora's box, the consequences of which are yet unseen, but ominous signs of which are now everywhere seen, in the growing sense of insecurity on the part of citizens in their homes and walking the streets. I walked by the police station not long ago and saw an 8-year-old boy struggling to chain his bicycle to a parking meter with a lock almost as big as his head. 8 years of age, and already convinced in this last quarter of the 20th century that he must lock up all of his possessions in front of, God help us, a police station. I talk to many men and women who, God help us, are afraid to walk at night on main and residential streets in this town. Then I visit their apartments and their homes, where there are 2 and 3 locks on the door. All this in a city and a province where a mere 40 years ago you were considered an eccentric indeed if you locked your door back or front. It is no use scoffing at and deploring the millions of Saturday night specials, handguns, in the United States, unless you are prepared to recognize that in that republic, quite largely through parole and massive plea bargaining and continued neglect by the executive arms of the judicial arms, in many areas their system of criminal justice has broken down. Now, if the tribe or the state fails or falters in its duty to members of the tribe and breaks the contract, can you seriously wonder for one moment if men and women take up their .22 caliber clubs to protect themselves and theirs and to exact their private vengeance or their retribution? A few short years ago, in Canada, a federal solicitor general and I regard myself as a Christian man, and therefore I won't give his name, appearing before a committee of the Canadian Senate, made the following statement. He said, "From now on, we are no longer interested in the protection of society. We are interested in the rehabilitation of the individual." As Solicitor General, he had responsibility for the penitentiaries and the parole board, amongst other responsibilities. Very clearly, under that philosophy, the prisons and the parole board were launched on a direct collision course with the judges, whose duty, as I have reminded you, is the protection of the public. What statements like that by a member of the executive function do to the function of judges, to the morale of police officers, and to the ancient covenant, I can leave you to guess. How did this unhappy and unsatisfactory situation arise? I do believe that a very good argument could be made for the theory that it was the direct result of a most unequal debate, which has been going on in a very lopsided fashion in Canada for close to 30 years. It was perhaps not even a debate at all. It was almost too one-sided to call it fairly that. In any event, for the past 30 years, hordes of criminologists, sociologists, and God help us, some professors of law, and psychiatrists, and others, all wedded to theories that crime was a result of bad toilet training, or cultural or economic deprivation, or the 101 reasons one can invent or employ to say why A hit B over the head and stole his purse. And mostly all of them agree that it was all society's fault, or his parents. They descended upon parliamentarians and members of the executive like locusts. Their views were progressive and humane and viable and exciting. And they are not to be derided for their enthusiasm. It was the same sort of enthusiasm which produced the Volstead or Prohibition Act in the United States. The fact that the cure was worse than the disease was not then evident. As can well be said of every act of human folly, it did seem like a good idea at the time. The fact that this dream, for such it was, that one could restructure all men's minds and redirect all their primordial instincts, did not square with original sin, or the fact that old Nick, my future boss, resides in all of us to some degree, did not seem to bother them. Why should it? After all, their mothers and their preachers had stopped reminding children that the road to hell is often paved with good intentions, and situation ethics were in, and value judgments, as you all know, were badly out. In fact, value judgments were a sin, as I understood it. In any event, as professors and professionals with access to research assistance, research grants, sabbaticals, and time to travel and to write, they had plenty of what experienced prison guards and experienced police officers and experienced trial judges who had seen an actual victim of crime or two, and who had seen what Homo sapiens can, fueled up, do on occasion, had not. The victims, of course, were silent in this debate. No one cared much in the debate about them. And besides, the criminologists were saying that they had brought it on themselves anyway. And they, too, had no research or travel grants or assistants or sabbaticals. One can understand why members of Parliament and the executive did not hear from the working professionals who had neither the time nor the means, and as silent services were precluded from engaging in this important debate. One suspects that the other two arms of government disremembered, quote, disremembered, unquote, the observation of that very articulate former United States Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Robert Gardner, who once observed in asking for more funds for vocational training as opposed to academic training, said, when you come right down to it, it is perhaps better for the nation that we have more plumbers whose pipes hold water than more philosophers whose theories don't. And while all this was going on, the media was cheerfully and happily interviewing in print, on radio, and on television the prisoners. Mostly they were heard to say, A, it wasn't their fault, B, they were wrongly convicted, C, society was to blame, and D, their imprisonment would make them worse, not better. The principle of equal time was neglected. Rarely, if ever, was the rest of the program devoted to interviews with the prisoners' victims of, say, in some cases, 100 or more, or the families of the victims, to tell of the traumas which affected the rest of their lives, or to the police officers who worked 24-hour stretches to catch him, and how that affected their domestic lives. If you spend enough time in a court of law, you learn that the truth is best arrived at by hearing all sides, not just the one. And that is exactly what has not been going on in Canada for the past 30 years, and that is why we have a parole system and temporary absences, growing crime and insecurity, the theory goes, and I subscribe to that theory. It is still true that a lie can go halfway around the world before the truth can put its boots on, but still hard facts have a way of catching up on theories in time. The National Parole Board hasn't learned that yet. You should read their literature. It pours out in an unending and expensive golden stream across the country. For myself, I do not wither to laugh or to weep when I read that literature. I think I enjoy humor, even unconscious, as well as the next man. And for example, when a past chairman of the board asserted that parolees, though released from custody, are, quote, still serving the sentence of the quote of the court, unquote, one has to, reading the court's warrant, which I just read to you, see the absurdity of the situation. Or another, quote, the board never purports to substitute its judgment for that of the court, unquote. You might try that one on the BC Court of Appeal, which increased a bank teller's sentence deliberately from 3 years to six, and then found a year later that she'd been released on parole to go to university to study social work. Or Mr. Andre Therrien, who is a board member, hearing from a woman being convicted and sentenced to 3 years for stabbing her mother, said in the presence of a Toronto Star reporter, he's going to grant her full parole immediately. Then he added, I can't see the why the hell she's in here. She's not a criminal. She is one of those cases where you have an accidental offender. Shrug. I'm not sure whether to laugh or cry when I read the board's repeated argument that it costs $16,000 a year or more to keep a prisoner in custody, and that it is much cheaper, therefore, to place him on parole, at least $10,000 cheaper a year. I imagine any woman in this audience would lift an eyebrow at the idea that it costs about $1,400 per month to keep a man in food, showers, TV programs, education, library, and a very limited wardrobe. The plain fact is that it doesn't cost $16,000 a year to keep a man incarcerated. It doesn't at all. I know this, that my friends, the prisoners, aren't getting it. And I have some friends in prison, I can tell you, but they're not getting it. That is the amount that the government chooses to expend on correctional matters. And that includes what a recent parliamentary inquiry found unanimously. When I said the government, I mean the federal government. I suspect there may be a representative of the provincial government here, and I wouldn't want him to leave feeling unhappy about this. A recent parliamentary inquiry found unanimously that there's a very high overhead in regional and national staff of prisons in Canada. And by contrast, for example, they found that the cost per prisoner in a comparable U.S. prison was $5,350 per inmate. Now, it's no function of mine to say whether the government's decision is right or wrong. I mention this only to point out the evidentiary weight which should be given to the board's evidence. No worse, the parole board has never even heard of double entry bookkeeping, where you show all the debits as well as all the assets. Wasn't it Oscar Wilde who defined a cynic as one who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing? And isn't that what we're talking about essentially here tonight? When they come to you and say, look how much money we're saving you. I've not brought here tonight my dossier and collection of horrible crimes committed by persons on parole and all the gory pictures, and I think wisely I've left them at home on good advice. But what value do you put on the traumatic effects to the wife and the children of a woman strangled in a parking lot by a man released on temporary absence? Or the family of the little girl who died for the same reason? You can't measure those things in dollars and cents. Just the same, those inarticulate, inchoate costs nowhere show on the parole board's balance sheet when they talk about how much money they're saving you. It is no secret that when a serious crime is committed, police forces now generally look first for a suspect amongst those on parole in temporary absence. A proper profit and loss sheet or balance sheet would show the man hours so expended. It would show the amount of unrecovered losses and lost wages and property to the victims, the costs of legal aid, Crown Counsel, the courts and jurymen involved in sometimes very lengthy preliminary hearings and trials, the cost to police and prosecutors in gathering evidence, and one good trial of that nature can easily cost up to $250,000. But none of them are referred at all in the National Parole Board's profit and loss statement. This, as a prospectus, I suspect, would not go beyond the reception office of any Securities Exchange Commission. One could go on. I could refer you to the suggestion that parolees and those on temporary absence are under the careful and effective surveillance of probation officers. If so, how could these violations occur? A man could report to a parole officer one afternoon and strangle a woman the next, and did. And I have the deepest respect for parole officers who have a tough job, I assure you. But they simply cannot supervise men for 24 hours a day. Many of you here tonight will recall the recent case of a young woman who was awarded about $431,000 by a justice of our Supreme Court last week. She got in the hands of a man on temporary absence who terrorized her, so the court found, involved her in a car accident, as a result of which she became quadriplegic. The court awarded her that close to $500,000. She's going to need care the rest of her life. She won't be able to collect a cent. The man has vanished now. The parole board can't be called upon to pay a cent, neither do the correctional authorities. Her only hope is to look to the ICBC, where she may collect $50,000, which you will pay for in your insurance rates. But I hope you're grateful about the $10,000 they saved you by letting them out. And I hope the young lady is too, though I don't blame her if she's not. Now I must turn finally to the occasional sheer arrogance of the National Parole Board. We spoke earlier of the respect which each of the three arms of government owe each other, not merely out of civility, but constitutional necessity. I'm going to tell you tonight of something which has never been published before. On the evening of February 15th, 1972, the then Chief Justice of this province convened a meeting at the law courts on Georgia Street in Vancouver with just about every judge of every court from the Court of Appeal to Provincial Court in attendance that night. We were there and gathered there to meet the late Mr. André Therrien, then a member of the parole board. Judges of all courts, from the highest court in this province down or up, depending on how you regard it, expressed to Mr. Therrien their very grave concerns about what the parole board was doing to their decisions and to their orders. Mr. Therrien assured the judges another member of the board would come back to them. One did, a Mr. S., a member of the board. Matter of fact, Mr. S. was then the junior member of the board, was the man they sent back. He was their junior man. I was summoned to the chambers of the then Chief Justice, a man whom Bruce Hutcheson, in his latest book, The Other Side of the Street, called quite accurately the finest citizen BC ever produced, and who at that time had sat as a trial judge as long as any judge in the whole of the British Commonwealth. And there, in the presence of that very great Chief Judge of British Columbia, in the presence of a Justice of the Supreme Court and a Judge of the County Court, I heard that junior member of the parole board address that Chief Justice in the following words. And I don't think I'll forget it as long as I live. And as I told you, Beelzebub is calling, and that won't be too long, I suspect. He said this: Chief Justice, we, and by we he meant the parole board, we are the experts on sentencing. The Chief Justice, who was a man of monumental restraint, said nothing to that patent absurdity. And quite undeterred, that junior member of the parole board went on to say this: He said, after all, we, that is the parole board, have the law on our side. The Chief Justice swung around in his chair and stared out over Robson Street what seemed to me then to be about 10 minutes, but which on reflection now was, I guess, about 10 seconds. Then he swung back in his chair and he said, young man, I know you have the law on your side. It is just the damn way you and your colleagues are exercising it that bothers me. And how right he was. And what has it all accomplished, this noisy, busy, and expensive Volstead-type experiment into changing human nature, and this frantic effort to make silk purses out of some proven sow's ears? Nothing. Nothing except the claim rehabilitation of those who would have gone straight anyway, after serving time, and the debasement of the judicial coinage, the pain and anguish to future victims who judges, perhaps naively, thought they had protected, and the diminution of the morale of the police, the growing insecurity of the citizens, and the invitation to more, not less, crime. On the average and on the whole, every statistic and every study I have seen demonstrates that, despite all and every earnest rehabilitative effort, the rate of recidivism remains unchanged for those who have had the benefit of these progressive programs as opposed to those who have not. One must sympathize with and honor those who have devoted their lives and their careers to the honorable pursuit of a mirage. Their anguish at the discovery that it was a chimera after all is to be understood, as is their reluctance to admit it. Nothing, somebody once said, is more brutal than the murder of a beautiful theory by a hard fact. Well, I am an old judicial plumber from Main Street and not a philosopher. And if you do not take my word that the great experiment is a failure, I will not be upset. In the past 3 years, a number of serious scholars who have been examining the results of this long and costly experiment, in which the punitive model has been replaced by the rehabilitative model, have all independently concluded that it was and is a failure. Robert Martinson, professor of sociology, City College, City of New York. James Q. Wilson, professor of government at Harvard University. Professor Isaac Ehrlich of the University of Chicago, with Professors Meiselman and Becker. Dr. Ernest Van Den Haag, psychiatrist and professor of social philosophy at New York University. Professor Andrew Von Hirsch, associate professor of criminal justice at Rutgers University, have each published studies and conclusions which demonstrate that all rehabilitative experiments are a failure, that the rate of recidivism remains the same for repeating offenders, that society is not savage when it asks for punitive and deterrent sentences, and that it is important for the fabric of society and the protection of society that the judgments of the judges be carried out. I'm not going to, of course, read all the footnotes and citations to those. Those works you can find and read for yourself, and I will leave with the chairman here a copy of this, and if you want to find these references, you're welcome to them, but I assure you they're most interesting. Professor Gordon Tullock of Virginia Polytechnic Institute recently stated, the standard criminologist has been living in a dream world for at least 150 years. They have thought that the cause of crime is not the economic return sought by some people, but an illness or some sort of disease. 80% of the people who seriously think about crime think of punishment as a deterrent, except for the sociologists. And they wrote all the books. Well, that's true, you know. The sociologists, the criminologists, and some errant and rascally professors of law as I reminded you, had all the time and all the resources to write the books. Whereas most grizzled police sergeants had not. I guess what Tulloch is telling you is what I'm trying to tell you, that we have suffered badly from a one-sided debate, as a result of which parliamentarians and governments and some judges and large numbers of the public have been led astray, if not plain brainwashed. Professor von Hirsch writes, "The simple fact is that the experiment to apply the rehabilitative or therapeutic approach to criminals and to crime has not worked out. Despite every effort and every attempt, correctional treatment programs have failed." Professor Wilson asserts that if the sentence of the judges were carried out, the rate of crime would drop dramatically. Professor Wilson concludes his book with these words: "Since the days of the Crime Commission," and he was a member of the President's Crime Commission in the United States and a highly regarded member, "we have learned a great deal, more than we are prepared to admit. Perhaps we fear to admit it because of a newfound modesty about the foundations of our knowledge, but perhaps also because the implications of that knowledge suggest an unflattering view of man. Intellectuals, although they often dislike the common person as an individual, do not wish to be caught saying uncomplimentary things about humankind. Some persons will shun crime even if we do nothing to deter them, while others will seek it out even if we do everything to reform them. Wicked people exist. Nothing avails except to set them apart from innocent people. And many people, neither wicked nor innocent, but watchful, dissembling, and calculating of their opportunities, ponder our reaction to wickedness as a cue to what they might profitably do. We have trifled with the wicked, made sport of the innocent, and encouraged the calculators. Justice suffers, and so do we all." With those words, I completely agree. Indeed, not only are the professors now alert that something has gone badly awry, the legislators have too. As of June 1976, the Hawaii State Legislature passed a bill which essentially says that anyone convicted of a serious offense must be sentenced on a second conviction to 5 years and on a third conviction to 10 years, and that there shall be no parole from any of those sentences. Many states of the United States are contemplating or enacting similar legislation. Presently, the United States Senate has before it a bill co-sponsored by Senators McClellan of Arkansas and Senator Edward Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts, who has, I think, never been regarded as a redneck before, which bill will, if passed, remove all parole for federal prisoners. Attorneys General William Saxby and Griffin Bell of that country both have pronounced the parole system and the rehabilitative approach a failure. Perhaps in Canada, in time, we can learn from our own mistakes and those of our southern neighbors before we are caught up in their agonies and repeat them. Out of respect for my many old friends in prison who write me now and again, it should be added that a great many prisoners agree that the whole parole process and apparatus should be done away with. And my feeling is that the prisoners, through the views they've expressed to me and through some of their spokesmen, and I hope that doughty little fighter Claire Culhane is here tonight, of the Prisoners' Rights Committee, Anyway, through their spokesmen and their communications that I've seen and heard, I think the majority of them feel that they'd rather do the time the judge gave them, straight time, than be subject to the whimsies and the eccentricities of the parole board. They complain bitterly, you know, with how much justice I cannot say, because I can't do justice to any complaint unless I've heard both sides or all sides. But they do complain persistently and frequently that they feel that the question of who gets admitted to parole and who doesn't, who gets yarded back off it and who doesn't, is sometimes capricious and too arbitrary. They don't know where they stand. And I sympathize with them deeply. It was correctly recorded that in the domain of Genghis Khan, a virgin could ride alone on a horse from one end of his empire to the other and be safe from any molestation. Frankly, I do not think we can achieve that standard of civilization in the immediate future. And for one thing, it would be very difficult to find in Canada today it would be difficult to find a horse that would go the distance, let's put it that way. It's not my fault. It's all your fault. Or your parents. It's probably your fault, because I can see a lot of you here are look as if you could have been parents or should have been. And the trouble is, you see, you fill all these rotten kids up with $10,000 worth of vitamins and then you send them out, and it's no wonder I can't find a horse to ride across Canada anymore. It's all your fault. In any event, for my part, as a journeyman judicial Main Street plumber, I will settle for a world where 8-year-old kids will not have to lock up their bicycles outside of police headquarters, where men and women can walk down any street or trail in this, my province, free and unafraid, and not have to cower like prisoners in their homes behind an array of bolts, bars, and locks. In short and in fine, I want the ancient covenant between the citizen and the state observed. And as a judge, I deem it my duty to do all I can to see that it is. I think, Mr. Chairman, my time's just about run out, and I know my voice is going to shortly. I'd like to say this. That if, in the course of my remarks to you this evening, I have expressed views and used words which have offended any of you, I'm sorry, because that is not my purpose in coming here. What I do believe in is that preface to the book called Disputed Passage, which reads this way, and I think some of you may have heard it before. It goes thusly: have you learned only from those who were kind to you and who agreed with you and who stood aside for you? Have you not also learned from those who opposed you and who disputed the passage with you? So if I've said some words that are offensive to you, I'm sorry, but I kind of suspect that that's what this 60-year-old institute is largely about, where speakers can come and give their honestly held beliefs and views, and you will listen to them patiently and kindly, as you have done to me. That's more than I hoped for when I came here. And I appreciate that, because that's the stuff of democracy, and that's how we learn, by not just agreeing with each other, but clashing views when we have to, in every good civilized sense. Now, Mr. Chairman, I can't guarantee this in this impermanent and very temporary world, but I strongly suspect that this is the last public speech I'm ever going to make again on the parole system or the parole board. I won't tell you all my reasons why, and some of them are dandies, I can tell you. But I'll tell you one reason why. Doing as much research as my trial work will allow me to do for this lecture to you tonight, I had a quick passing reference to the public accounts of the Government of Canada. Well, it was late at night, I think it was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm not sure if I remember the figures correctly, but I think they read this way. That last year, the parole board, National Parole Board, spent about $18 or $19 million, and the public accounts estimate that they're going to require close to $29 million next year. Considerable jump. And I thought about that for a while, and I thought, well, $29 million is a powerful figure. And then I went in the shoebox where I keep my own war chest, and I checked it again, and as I suspected, I had exactly $29 in it. And there's no way I can add to my own war chest, because my wife has found out that I've been stealing from the grocery money to get it. So that source is cut off. So I began to figure that $29 against $29 million isn't going to go too far. And this fight may be a little more one-sided than I thought it was going to be. So I think just maybe it's time for the public, time for the professors, time for the legislators, time for the executive to have a good look at the whole system, and time for Canada to have a darn good debate about it all. Mr. Chairman, I thank you again for your kindness. I bid you, hopefully, a safe journey home. And hopefully, a safe good night.
As is the custom of the Institute, before allowing you to take your chances outside, Judge Bewley has agreed to answer questions from the audience. Yes.
What is, in your opinion, sir, the most direct way?
Excuse me, sir. May I say something before you begin? As you can see, I'm getting a little old and decrepit now. I've spent so many years listening to these lawyers that I suffer from the occupational diseases of judges. I'm getting a little hard of hearing. And like most of them, I'm too vain to wear a hearing aid. So may I ask you, sir, and others who wish to ask questions, to please bellow at me. And if my answer doesn't seem to make sense, it's not because I'm not making sense, it's because I haven't really heard all you say. Go ahead, sir.
What, in your opinion, is the most effective and direct way an individual could help you in your crusade, let's call it, to get rid of this parole board? Could you write to your member, or write to the Minister of Justice, or what is the quickest way get some action, or assistance in getting some action taken?
All right. Fairly stated, but let me get off the hook that you, yes.
You could repeat the question. Some of the audience may not have heard it.
Right. The chairman asked me to repeat the question, which is, and I hope I do him justice, he says, what is the best way the average citizen can go about helping me in my crusade to get rid of the National Parole Board? Well, I better enter a disclaimer here, sir. No judge should be on a crusade to get rid of a federal agency, or even a provincial one, God help me. I can think of some provincial ones I'd like to talk about, but I won't tonight. No, I'm not really on a crusade. I'm just expressing some serious concerns as a judge and a citizen. If you feel, as I feel, and many do feel, that Parliament should look at this, because remember, the Parole Act is a recent creature. It only came in 1951. It's a very recent creature. I've told you of its antecedents and how it was born out of wedlock and all the rest. But I think now that Parliament has an opportunity to hear from citizens who say, we think you should examine this and re-examine it, and tell your Member of Parliament to read the books I've quoted to you and accept their assurances that they're simply wasting money in future if they carry on this way. I think the most effective thing that any citizen in any democracy can do is write as a Member of Parliament. I really do. I guess that's all you can do, if that's what you want.
Yes.
Is mandatory parole different from the parole you have been talking about?
Well, I don't believe in mandatory parole either, sir. You know, there are generally two types of parole. There's the parole which a man gets before he has served his full time, right?
That's when he gets the third remittance.
Yeah. And then the mandatory parole is what he has to endure for the last third of his sentence, which he should be entitled to be free from anyway under the regulations, you see. That's his time off for good behavior. And the prisoners resent being under that mandatory parole when they've done their time, behaved themselves, done good time, served good time, and they should be able to walk away from it. They've paid the price then, and they shouldn't have any strings on them. And they get angry because mandatory parole means you do have strings on you. See?
That could last for longer than the one third as well.
Well, it can, because if you get into trouble on mandatory parole, they can yard you back and you lose your good time and remission and everything else. You could end up spending much more time than the judge ever intended to send you to.
And it depends on the whim of the parole officer.
Call it whim if you like, but I prefer to describe it as that mysterious and completely incomprehensible formula by way they work things.
Judge Bewley, do you think sentences should ever be reviewed? Is there any reason for any rationale behind reviewing their sentences? And if so, is your main argument that it's usurping the judge's function? And would you say that it should be reviewed by judges rather than by an administrative body?
I guess you all heard that question, didn't you? Some didn't. Well, this gentleman said, do I think that judges should be reviewed only by, do I think that sentences should be reviewed only by judges or by other bodies? Do I have that right, Doctor?
Yes. Well, is there ever a time when sentences should be reviewed, and if so, should it only be by judges?
Right. Is there ever a time when sentences should be reviewed, and if so, should it be only by judges? Well, I think there should always be a time when a sentence is open to review. You see, judging is a very human and a very wearing business, I can tell you. And when the judge takes off his white hat and has to put on his black hat and sentence a man to custody, which he does not like doing, he may not be in a very good frame of mind that day. You know, judges are human like the rest of you. He may have had a fight with his wife, or he may have been mad at his administrative judge, or 110 reasons why a judge could be out of sorts. Judges aren't ever supposed to be out of sorts. They're supposed to be saints and calm and cool and collected at all times. But it's impossible for humans to be that good all the time. Everybody's going to make a mistake or an error. So I think it should be open at all times for a particular trial judge's sentence to be reviewed. I think by judges. I'm not afraid of other judges reviewing my sentences at all. They can take it a long, cool second look and a third look, and they do sometimes take a fourth look at sentences. I hope that answers your question, sir. Yes, it doesn't, obviously. Yes.
What I'm referring to is something like parole, like a review 5 or 10 years down the line, not a review of your decision at the time, but a review later on.
Mm.
Is that what you're addressing right now? That kind of review should be done by a judge.
Well, if you had to do that, I'd prefer a judge did it. And the ideal situation would be that they'd come back with that man 4 or 5 or 6 years after the same judge or other judges and say, all right, what you judges think, should we let him go? Still, I must prefer the straight, flat sentence and no mucking about with it. I think the prisoners prefer that too. And I think the coinage of the validity of the whole judicial process requires that too. All right. Did that answer it?
Yes, it did.
Okay. You looked a little doubtful. Your left eyebrow is up a quarter of an inch in it.
Good vision.
Okay.
Yes.
Do you think since judges have become accustomed to giving sentences on the basis of parole and perhaps giving a longer sentence, anticipating that a smaller period will be served, if and when parole is eliminated, can you visualize judges changing their attitude and their sentences?
You haven't identified yourself, ma'am. Are you the lady who I think you are? Would it do you any harm if I said hello, Mrs. Hi. Hello, Mrs. Clary Culhane. Prisoner's rights spokesman. Awful rebel. Must be a thorn in many sides. Not yet. Not yet. We haven't tangled really yet now. Okay. Well, Mrs. Culhane is asking me if it's possible that the trial judges consciously or unconsciously lengthen their sentences knowing that the parole board might affect them and carve them up some way. Ms. Kane, I think it could happen. Most judges I know, and we've talked about this and we're worried about it, and we've agreed, all that I've talked to resist that temptation, because that could be terribly unfair to increase a man's sentence on the expectation he might be given a parole, because we know darn well now, as you know, that it may not be given, and capriciously so. So we've decided, every judge I know says it would be most unfair to do that. But I kind of suspect that if we had flat, straight, full-time sentences, that the sentences on the average would be a little shorter, knowing that they'd be carried out for a change. Yeah, I think so.
Judge Buehle, the parole board presumably came in part because there were cases in the past where people were given unusually long sentences, some of them 60 or 70 years. One saw people who were in their 70s still serving the 80-year terms in jail. I want to extend the question you asked before. Wouldn't you, in cases where people were really rather old, be in favor of reviews by judges of very long sentences?
Mm-hmm. Well, let us remember this, you see, that if that was the reason or one of the reasons why the parole board or the parole act came into existence, well, that is a reason which Parliament had in its power to cure, because Parliament, you know, by its act, decides what's the maximum sentence I can give. And all Parliament has to do is to say that I cannot send somebody to prison for 80 years, or any sentence combined add up to 80 years, and that will be done. They don't have to bring in a parole board to do that simple thing, you see. So,
that would be easy to cure.
Hmm?
Oh,
yes. Sure, that's completely within Parliament's power. Yes, I can't quarrel with that.
Judge Buehle, the parole system as you outline it, is this peculiar to the North American continent? Could you tell us happens in other countries such as England and perhaps Japan?
What happens in England and Japan with respect to what, ma'am?
The parole
system. I don't know. I don't know. I haven't had time to dig into the Japanese approach. Oh, I've touched on the English approach, but I haven't had time to dig into it. Remember, I've only got $29 and no research assistant. If we have a repeat hitman who's convicted, a killer, a professional killer, and he's convicted, why should there be a limit to his sentence? Well, I don't know. I personally hope that Parliament might give the courts the power to have him executed with the same weapon he used. But again, ma'am, it's up to Parliament to decide what the extent of his sentence can be, the full extent, or how he serves it.
Yeah. You mentioned legislation put through by the state of Hawaii, something about 5 years for second offenders and 10 years for third offenders. What would be your suggestion for people who repeat offenses? Should they be imprisoned for life?
I'm not getting this, don't you? Mm-hmm. Excuse me, I'm having a little trouble. This young fellow's got a pair of good ears. He'll interpret for me.
Well, I think the question is what if the state of Hawaii is suggesting mandatory sentences of a certain length, what would be your suggestion for what mandatory sentences there should be for repeat offenders?
More precisely for offenders of more than three times, shall we say. Since Hawaii is chosen to divide it into two times for five, each of five, for three, each of ten. You know, what do you get for four?
In a sense, the question concerns then what you do with a habitual offender.
Right, exactly.
Well, I know what I've done with some habitual offenders whom I've had to find just that under the law. But little collection of cases I made up a few years ago, 64 cases. Of those 64 cases I documented, 12 of them had been found by the courts to be habitual offenders and had been sentenced by the courts to preventive detention for life. 12 of them. And not only had they been sentenced by the courts, but in most cases, their cases, that sentence had been reviewed by provincial courts of appeal, and in quite a few of their cases by the Supreme Court of Canada, and those findings were all upheld that they were habitual criminals, they should be locked away for the rest of their lives. But as you see, in the 60-odd cases I documented, 12 of those were habitual criminals. Each one of those had been released on parole and committed indictable offenses whilst on parole. And some of them, Lord help us, have been released as much as four times and committed indictable offenses, you see. So what you do with an habitual criminal, I don't know. We've done all we can by sending them to prison. It's up to the members of Parliament now to decide whether they want to make a sentence for life, a real life sentence. It's up to them to do it. Yes, sir. In the yellow sweater.
Remain in prison, it seems to me the punitive aspect is no longer of any consequence. And I wonder if you support the idea of restructuring prisons for people who are going to be permanently divorced from society.
I missed the last half of that there.
Would you be in favor of restructuring prisons for people who were going to be on long term or permanent sentences?
Hmm. Yes, I think I would. I don't see any reason why you have to make a man live a miserable animal-like existence once I, as society's instrument, have calmly decided that he must be sequestered from his human beings. I don't think you have to make his life an animal existence any more than you absolutely need to. I don't sentence a man to jail ever to be buggered or raped or assaulted. When I send a man to jail, that's not what I expect will happen. And I expect the executive will so run its affairs so that the Queen's writ will run just as clearly inside that prison as it will on Main Street or on the university campus either. I think he's deserved the protection of the law. Yes, I would restructure those long-term prisons, and they don't even have to look like fortresses for that matter, you know. I think they can be treated decently and compassionately and humanly, but sequestered. My God, if they want conjugal visits, why not? You know, come to think of it, if you took that $29 million the parole board might be spending next year and divided it up by the 9,000-plus federal prisoners, who are, after all, only 1/300th of 1% of Canada's total population. We're not talking about many men and women now, you know. And you divide it up amongst the 9 or 10,000 prisoners, they won't all be released in 1 year. You could probably give them a stake of about $17,000 or $18,000 to come out and rehabilitate themselves with. Might not be a bad idea. Let's think about it.
Well, if I think we have imposed on Judge Bewley sufficiently for this evening, I would like to make two announcements. First, of next week's speaker, who will be Sir Derek Barton on the classification of crises. I'd also like to announce that we continue to solicit your memberships, which will ensure that you get the program for the second half of the season in the spring, and you may become members at the table on your way out. And finally, I would like to ask Vice President Conaghan to thank Judge Bewley on our behalf.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, Judge Bewley has a well-established reputation as a man of strong conviction, a courageous man who is prepared to speak out from time to time on issues and realizing that his points of view may not always be universally accepted, a trait, unfortunately, or a quality that is not always found among people who occupy positions of public trust. Your Honor, this evening you have lived up to your past reputation by providing your audience with stimulating and provocative thoughts on a subject which you feel very deeply about and which I suspect many people in society also feel deeply about. It's my extreme pleasure, on behalf of the Vancouver Institute and your audience, to thank you for coming along here this evening to share your thoughts with us. Thank you very much, Judge.